Jack was reaching the stage of boredom when he was considering taking out the dowsing rods that had lain in his wardrobe since the prophet days, and giving them another try, when the letter arrived from the sainted aunt. Letters from Aunt Penelope had been thin on the ground since the family reunion debacle at Easter. Indeed, most of the family had hoped that diplomatic relations would be cut off for a long time to come, if not forever. Normally, only Mrs. Bagthorpe would read Aunt Penelope's letters, possibly quoting the odd snippet to the rest, and answer them. On this occasion, however, she stopped the whole family in its tracks by reading out the whole thing. The Bagthorpes were all arguing noisily at the time, between mouthfuls of toast or cereal. Mrs. Bagthorpe believed that meals should be civilized occasions, with a brisk and lively interchange of views and opinions, even breakfast. "Hush, darlings," she cried, brandishing the letter, "you must listen to this." Grandma, who had just entered, took her seat, glanced at the missive, and remarked, "It is from that dreadful woman who married my eldest and best-loved son, and is feeding her family on nuts and grass." None of this was true. Henry himself was her favorite son, because he had plenty of fight, and she could conduct frequent and truly stupendous rows with him. Claude, a minister, was a very mild man, and a disappointment to her in this respect. Aunt Penelope and Uncle Claude had certainly turned vegetarian, but did not, so far as the others knew, eat grass. No one, however, argued. It was a whole lot of trouble to argue with Grandma, and on this occasion definitely not worth it. "Luke has already reached the semi-final of the Young Brain of Britain contest," Mrs. Bagthorpe exclaimed, ignoring this interruption. This intelligence met with stony silence from her offspring, and a further speech from Grandma. "She will never rear those children," she said, "if, indeed, they are children. Why do they never raise their voices? Why do they never shout? Their blood has been turned to water." "Their brains haven't," said Rosie gloomily. "Trust that revolting Luke. I bet he cheated." "Let me read you the whole letter," said Mrs. Bagthorpe. "It is full of news." Mr. Bagthorpe looked up from behind his newspaper. "I shall not be required to listen, I hope," he said. "I am engaged in an extremely complex and demanding creative exercise, and the least thing will destroy my balance. If necessary, I shall cover my ears." He retreated behind his paper, and Mrs. Bagthorpe took a deep breath and prepared to regale her unenthusiastic audience. "Dear Laura," she read, "we trust and pray that yourself, dear Henry, and the family are thriving and well, despite your corrupt diet." There came here a snort from behind Mr. Bagthorpe's newspaper, which seemed to indicate that he was not managing not to listen. "There is very little news to tell," Mrs. Bagthorpe continued, "other than that Claude and myself feel so blessed in our children, and are continually offering up thanks for them. I am sending, under separate cover, an inscribed copy of the volume in which four of dear little Esther's poems appear. And I know that you will all be thrilled to hear that dear Luke has now reached the semi-final of the Radio Young Brain of Britain contest. He is indeed the youngest child ever to do so." William muttered something under his breath, and to Jack it sounded like, "Bloody hell!" It may have sounded like this to his mother as well, because she frowned reprovingly over the top of the letter, before continuing. "Claude and I are naturally exceedingly proud of them both, and I know that you will rejoice with us. And Solomon's wisdom excelled the wisdom of all the children of the East Country, and all the wisdom of Egypt." 1 Kings 4:30. "You will be interested to know that tomorrow dear great Aunt Lucy is coming to be our guest for several days."
"In Torquay."
"What?" Here Mr. Bagthorpe threw down his newspaper on the marmalade pot, and abandoned all pretense of not listening. "We have always been so fond of her," continued his wife, "and the dear children write to her almost every week. We shall do all possible to make her stay happy, and also to see the error of her ways, and turn to a more natural and wholesome diet. Blessings on you all. God be with you, Penelope."
"Hell's bells!" fumed Mr. Bagthorpe. "The woman's a—"
She's a whited sepulchre, a snake in the grass. She's a worm in the... That is enough, Henry, said Grandma, interrupting her son's flow of mixed metaphors. We all know perfectly well why you are in this childish tantrum. You do not deceive us for a moment. You care not a fig for Lucy. This was true. Mr. Bagthorpe did, at rare intervals, make a fleeting visit to great-aunt Lucy in Torquay. He did this partly to get away from his own family, and partly because great-aunt Lucy had few surviving relations and was extremely rich. The thought that Aunt Penelope was now also putting herself in the way of a hefty bequest was too much for him. "She will be driven mad within the week by that bunch of Latter-day Saints," Mr. Bagthorpe fulminated, "and as likely as not alter her will while the balance of her mind is disturbed by nuts and water." He then rounded on his own offspring. "Why don't you lot write letters every week?" he demanded. "What's the matter with you? Have you no concept of which side your bread is buttered?" "I don't think I ever really do anything Great-Aunt Lucy would be interested in," said Jack honestly. His siblings were all more concerned with Luke than the matter of bequests and such like. "She'll have to come here," Mr. Bagthorpe said. "Invite her, Laura. Do it now."
"But, Henry, darling, you are in the middle of such a difficult piece of work," his wife protested.
"To hell with that," he said tersely. "Invite her. And you lot, you just keep yourselves within bounds while she's here. I warn you, I can hardly afford to keep you as it is. If I am now to be sold down the river for a mess of pottage, I shall certainly not be able to afford it."
"You could always borrow off Zero," suggested Jack helpfully. "He'd lend you some, wouldn't you, old chap?"
Zero moved his tail in a way that could in no way be described as enthusiastic, and Mr. Bagthorpe pushed back his chair and stood up. "That piece of uncalled-for sarcasm is all I needed," he said. "The day I am reduced to borrowing money from a dog, and in particular a numbskulled, pudding-footed, matted-up hound like—"
"Don't, father," pleaded Jack. "I'm sorry. I didn't mean it like that. I didn't mean to be sarcastic."